I bet daily friendship with that bottle attracts more people to advertising than any salary you could dream of.
That's why I got in.
So enjoy it.
Doing my best here.
Oh, you're not. You don't know how to drink, your whole generation. You drink for the wrong reasons. My generation, we drink because it's good. Because it feels better than unbuttoning your collar. Because we deserve it. We drink because it's what men do.
Mad Men is pretty accurate at depicting the advertising industry in the late 1950s and 1960s, but it doesn't pretend to be a documentary film. It is committed to storylines and pure entertainment, smartly focusing on the lives and loves of its central characters and their hallowed clients. However, what is the real story of the decade? The passion, madness, and mayhem that was all part of the creative revolution. Well, advertising veteran Andrew Cracknell tells that story in his new book, The Real Mad Men, The Renegades of Madison Avenue, and The Golden Age of Advertising. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Andrew to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the show first, and then we'll talk about The Real Mad Men. But what do you think it is about this subject and this time period that has lured us in so?
Glamour, I think, and also the depiction of glamour. It is slightly exaggerated. I don't think any of us dressed quite so glossily and quite so well, so it is made to look even better than it was. But it was a time of plenty. It was, in most respects, a time of optimism. And I think, although funnily enough, when you think about it, the bomb was hanging over the whole thing. It just seems, when we look back, that it was a simpler time. And that really is its allure, you know, a sort of time of greater security. I certainly didn't feel that at the time. Living in England, under the four-minute warning, you know, we could be incinerated within 4 minutes. But now when I look back, like we all do with nostalgia, it just does seem a period of much greater certainty, much greater security. And, of course, considerable wealth in New York City at the time. I mean, the city was really booming. And that's the background to the series.
What was it about that time that brought about Madison Avenue and this incredible power? Because it sort of went with the power of radio, television, and other media.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating. And one of the best bits of putting the book together was piecing this together. Although I knew it, I wasn't exactly there. I got into advertising in London in the late 60s, but I knew what was going on there. But there are three things, really. There was the most extraordinary economic boom in New York as a city. And, of course, there was in the country, which fueled the need for the product of the agencies themselves, advertising. So advertising went through this massive boom, massive expansion, needing more and more staff. Then there was the biggest cultural explosion the world has ever seen, which is surprisingly unremarked. People talk about Medici, they talk about the end of the 19th century in Paris, but really, no one's ever seen a bigger and more comprehensive culture and creative explosion than happened in New York. And this is essentially a New York story, you know. It couldn't have happened anywhere else. That explosion between really the end of the Second World War and the mid to late 60s, where not only did they conquer and revolutionize every medium, they actually started inventing new media as well, like the poetry jazz fusion. So you've got this tremendous economic background. You've got a creative background an artistic background that the new generation of creative people are growing up with. And you've then got this one man, Bill Birnbach, who suddenly realized that, or he'd realized throughout the 50s, actually throughout his career in the 40s even, that the only people that an agency had that were really, really important were the creative people, because they could do the one thing the client couldn't do, which is have advertising ideas. So he elevated their importance. He also opened the door to Jewish writers and mainly Italian art directors who came flooding in with the confidence of the second and third generation immigrant. So you've really got those four things: a cultural explosion, economic explosion, a change in the way agencies were run, and a change in the nature of the people who were doing the work, who were confident, they were much more volatile, they hated everything about advertising that had gone before, as did most of the American population. I mean, people were sick of advertising by the late 1950s. The fact there was so much more of it made it even worse. And so you've got this perfect situation to completely revolutionize not just the activity, but the content of advertising.
You mentioned something I found fascinating, that you came into the late 1960s, but you were aware of what was happening. How aware do you think they were at the time that they were revolutionizing the ad business? So they were starting a revolution and they were changing it beyond recognition.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because you often wonder, people who live through revolutions, and that's of course like violent, you know, storming the Bastille type revolutions,
right,
whether they really know they're doing it. But I think they did. You know, I talked to over 50 of them, and they're really proud of what they did. I think they did because it was almost a visceral thing. The reason why I've got so much respect for Mad Men is that I think for 90% of the business through the 60s, it's a pretty accurate portrayal. The big old agencies went on much as they always had done. They behaved much as they had done in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, into the 60s. This revolution was sort of on the margins in terms of economic activity, but it completely radicalized the way everybody looked at their ads. It just took the other agencies a long time to catch up. So in answer to your question, yes, they did know they were in a revolution because they could see the others who weren't. Do you see what I mean? It was there was a sort of daily side-by-side comparison every time you looked at your newspaper or turned on your television. The ads being done by the new agencies and the behavior of the new agencies, the smell of the new agencies, the body language of the new agencies was so different from all the others.
And those advertisements were so candid. And one of the things that comes out in your book and even in the series is that they were witty and they were exciting and they were different. And
yes,
there was a freshness to them.
Well, that's partly to do with the sort of immigrant intrusion. The one word, and I put it in the book, the one word that they used more consistently than anything else, all the people I spoke to, was phony. They hated the phoniness of the business. And that's what they wanted to change. And then along comes this man, Bill Birnbach, and one of his many, many, many brilliant quotes, and you can look them all up on the web, was the most powerful weapon you can use in advertising is the truth. And what they managed to do was make the truth look appealing, even in some very ordinary products, or Me Too products, like, for example, Chivas Regal Whiskey. They found a way of engaging the public. It wasn't at the expense of the product. They didn't really laugh at their own product. But I think a key to the way those people felt was that they knew, that the public knew, that this was transactional. We're going to play the part of somebody who's going to sell you something. Now you're going to play the part of somebody who's going to buy it. We both sides know this is a game. Let's stop pretending it's anything other than a transaction. So let's at least relax and have some fun with it. And that's why so many of those ads were, whilst being very hardworking, were presented in a rather frivolous way. But that frivolity was not misplaced. It was often mistaken by lesser creative people. They thought, oh, all we've got to do is take the mickey out of the product or say outrageous things and get attention, and that's what's called great advertising. It wasn't. There was a tremendous discipline to what Birnbach and his followers did. They still knew they had to sell a product, but they just did it in a much more demotic and approachable way.
And that is different. I think that's what I found fascinating about the book, because you can be revolutionary and still have the work be different but not hold up. But you look at the advertising and the work that was produced during this era, and it's some of the finest ever. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, funny enough, I was asked that this morning, was this advertising's greatest era? And I definitely think it was. I really do. I mean, I don't think things changed quite as radically as they changed then. And I think the produce of those few agencies throughout the 1960s was truly remarkable and radical. And, you know, lots of people have done great ads since, but in a way they were doing it on those people's backs. You know, those people had convinced the clients that this new and sometimes apparently dangerous way of doing it would work. And, you know, the first people in always make it a little bit easier for the next people in. And I, on the subject of clients, if I had had another chapter, I would have devoted it to clients, because every single one of those great campaigns I talk about in the book, by definition, had a great client behind them, because those people were taking the biggest risk. The agency could always go on and work for somebody else, but you know, you're head of Avis, or you're head of VW, or you're head of Seagram, or you're head of Xerox. And it's your money, it's your head on the block, and you say, yeah, we're going to do something that's never been done before, we're going to advertise, you know, we're only number two. I mean, just unthinkable in the US in those days to admit to you being number two. And research told them that. But Bill Birnbach at the agency and Robert Townsend, the client, said, no, we don't care. We think we're number two. We try harder. That's what makes sense. That's what we're going to do. And they were proved to be right. Great clients.
Andrew Cracknell is a advertising veteran. He's the author of the book, The Real Mad Men, The Renegades of Madison Avenue in the Golden Age of Advertising. You mentioned Bill Birnbach, and we've talked about him several times in the course of our conversation. You write about him. You write about David Ogilvy, Helmut Krohn, Phyllis Robinson, George Lois, Carl Alley, Mary Wells, Marion Harper. It is a very impressive list, isn't it?
It is, yes. I suppose, by definition, because I am don't forget, I'm the sort of archivist of this particular piece of history, so what I choose to say obtains for the purpose of this book. But I would say, because it was such a remarkable time, there were more remarkable people in advertising then. And also the nature of the people who are fated has changed a little bit in those days. Because advertising became a publicly quoted activity and companies were quoted on Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange, suddenly the media interest in advertising figures stopped to be about the people who did the ads and became more about the people who ran the agencies. So, you know, with no disrespect to Martin Sorrell, you're far more likely to hear Martin Sorrell on the radio, say here or there, than you are any individual creative director, because now advertising is allegedly a business. They want to hear from the businessmen and not necessarily the people who actually do the business, the creative people.
Of the list of people that we talked about and I just mentioned, yeah, what made them stand out? What was it about? I mean, we talk about the work and how it stood the test of time, but their practice and the fact that they were able to connect with the people was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, within that list of people you've read out, there's people who are on there, and you're quite rightly picking them out for different reasons. I mean, Helmut Krohn, for example, he is there because he was an absolute past master as an art director. You know, he was careful, he was fastidious, he was actually a pain in the ass to work with because he had to get everything so exact. Julian Koenig was just a wonderfully demotic writer who just knew the perfect turn of phrase. And a sort of copy, when you read it, you don't really notice it's great copy until you go back and read it again. That's the best copy that doesn't draw attention to itself. Marion Harper is at the completely different end of the spectrum. He was a businessman, but he invented the advertising conglomerate, and he's probably the biggest shaper of that decade, the future following that decade, because now nearly 80% of all advertising business goes through marketing services conglomerates like WPP and Omnicom and Interpublic. And those organizations were his idea. Mary Wells, probably arguably the most successful American businesswoman of any time in any business, because apart from else, she was the first ever CEO of a publicly quoted US company, was an extraordinary glamorous and stylish and articulate and clever copywriter who started her own agency in 1966 with two Jewish creative people. She was a creative person. That would have been unheard of 6 years before. Two Jews, a woman, and all of them creative, starting an agency. It was a phenomenal success. And she moved advertising into its next phase, where it wasn't just about ads, it was about creating news. You know what I mean? Where, you know, she took Braniff Airlines apart. She got the count. She didn't decide just to do nice ads for Braniff. She said, no, we're not going to do an ad until we've completely redesigned this airline and painted the planes different colors and got Emilio Pucci to design the outfits for the what used to be called cabin attendants and because of her became called stewardesses or hostesses. Completely different interiors, different meals, different ticketing. Completely changed the behavior of the airline, made every flight a party, and then advertised that. That was the next move on. That's more about what an agency does these days, a more holistic approach to a client's problem. So George Lois is on that list, should be on that list, one of the greatest art directors and advertising thinkers ever, who, apart from some great ads, did a decade of absolutely wonderful Esquire covers. Mm.
You include those in the book, some of the Esquire covers.
I do in the book, yeah, because
they're amazing.
I think although they're not purely advertising, I think they work like ads. And George is essentially still an advertising art director. And that anybody talking about a body of commercial work, commercial art during the 1960s has got to include the Esquire covers. So these people are on that list for just being absolutely superb or remarkably, you know, extraordinary at individual disciplines within advertising. Harper is a businessman, Lois is an art director, Koenig is a writer, Ed McCabe is another writer that should be on that list. Birnbach, of course, is a sort of orchestrator, good creative person himself as well. They just seem to be an era, perhaps sparked off by the elements I was talking about earlier, where there were more giants than any other time. And of course, this is all retrospective. This is the benefit of hindsight.
Of course, one of the themes of the show is women in the workforce and their role taking shape. You have an entire chapter devoted to women in the industry. Give us a sense of that role and how it grew over that decade.
Well, if it just very quick history, there were women copywriters in the 1890s. There's a rather famous woman called Minnie Maud Hanf who invented the character Sunny Jim for Forced Breakfast cereal. There had always been women writers. It was one of the areas where women had done reasonably well in that business. They came as Peggy, and I met three in my interviews, women who'd started agencies as secretaries and transferred across to be, one of them, Joy Golden, was a woman who started in BBDO in 1954 in the Steno pool, decided she could do the ads better than the people she saw around her, did a sheaf of her own ads, took them to her, to a creative group head who happened to be a woman, Jean Rindlaub, and she gave her a job. They also came through the advertising departments of the big stores, because this was a grand time for women's clothing stores and those big department stores on Fifth Avenue and Sixth Avenue. And some of them came through women's magazines. So there'd always been quite a few women writers. No women visualizers, no women account service staff, partly because clients didn't want them, partly because the job involved so much sort of male, macho entertainment, you know, backslapping stuff in strip clubs and late nights in restaurants and too many martinis that actually women had far too much sense and probably wouldn't have been allowed in half the places the blokes were going. So there weren't, most of the women in agencies were secretarial, apart from quite a few writers. And Peggy's life, I think, is pretty accurate. You know, a lot of casual sexism, a lot of having to work twice as hard just to make the same impact as any of the men writers, probably consigned to, you know, women's only products like, you know, Sanpro products and stuff like that. A ceiling that wasn't even glass, it was just concrete. I mean, in the 1950s at J. Walter Thompson, even if you were a senior woman writer, you weren't allowed. You're allowed only one day a week in the director's dining room. The rest of the time, your meal is brought to you on a trolley by a woman wearing the same meal as they were getting in the boardroom, brought to you on a trolley by a woman in a full maid's outfit, brought to your desk by your typewriter. It's just ridiculous, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah.
So I think everything you see about the way that Joan works and the way that Peggy works is pretty much spot on.
As is the womanizing, I assume.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was. You know, it wasn't that much different here either. There was an agency I worked at in the 1970s in London that reminded me very much of how Sterling Cooper is portrayed in the 1960s.
How do you think the industry has changed? And have there been detrimental changes?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have to be careful here because I really don't want to paint myself into an old farts corner. I think the detrimental change is not. It's been forced on the business by the general sort of confusion that the web has caused. Nobody really yet knows, and I'm not sure they ever will because of the speed that it evolves. Nobody quite yet knows really what to do about the web. And, you know, it was pretty easy to corral television or corral print or corral billboards or radio. This is how we use it. Do you see what I mean? It was a much more sort of monocultural thing. But with the web, there are so many different ways of doing it, and people inventing stuff so fast, and it's changing so quickly, that the business itself is a bit of a mess. And that sounds more pejorative than it's supposed to be. It's just the area in which it's operating is so confused and confusing that the business itself can't help be that. In that loss of simplicity, I think it's lost a lot of its own sort of enjoyment. You know, you're so busy trying to keep up and figure out what's going on. There's little time left to celebrate doing what you actually do. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And here again, you've been talking about writing about this time with a perspective, with hindsight, which we don't have in the current work. We have to wait and see how it holds up, right?
Yes. I do talks on this around agencies in London and in New York last week. And one thing I'm very careful to say, when, because you see lots of young creative people turn up to hear about the book and the work that was done, and I'm very careful to say that I don't think it's your fault. If it looks to you like I'm standing in front of here and saying, wasn't this work great in those days, isn't it terrific, I don't think it's your fault, you next generation, that you're not doing work like this, because things are so much more difficult. I mean, a very simple thing like the client-agency relationship. In those days, there was no management consultancy. There were no branding agencies. There were no marketing agencies. There were accountancy firms stuck to accounting and auditing. They didn't give management advice. Banks just lent money. Now there's so many different people clambering over a client. You know, in those days, if you made, I don't know, farm machinery out in the Midwest, when you came up to New York, there were only two people you probably wanted to see, your bank, maybe not even that, and your advertising agency. So you're the owner-operator of a big industrial company or a commercial company or a food company or something like that. One of the few people that you would consider to be your peers and on whom you would lean for general advice, business advice, would be your advertising agency proprietor. Now, of course, the proprietor is lucky to get in to see anybody at board level. You know, marketing directors aren't always necessary on the clients, on the boards of client companies. So agencies have moved a long way down and off that top table and actually out into an outer room somewhere and no longer have the ear that they used to have of the people who run the big companies. And that has lengthened lines of communication, muddied the approval systems, and everything is much more confused. It's not as simple as it used to be. And I go around showing two-minute television commercials. You know, nobody makes a two-minute television commercial, maybe once a year for the Super Bowl.
Right.
So those people, they had it easier in those ways. But, of course, they had it much more difficult in another way, in that they were fighting an advertising culture that treated the consumer with absolute contempt. That's why it was so unpopular by the end of the 50s. Just treated consumers like idiots and just bashed them over the head with relentlessly boring and moronic messages over and over and over again, night after night after night. And they had to fight against that. So they had their own, they didn't have it all their own way. They had their own battles and it was tough for them too. But I think I'd rather have been them than a 25-year-old now. And, and I say that with great sympathy. I bet you they still have fun though.
I bet they do.
I hope they do.
Andrew Cracknell is the author of The Real Mad Men, The Renegades of Madison Avenue and the Golden Age of Advertising. The book is published by Running Press. Andrew, I thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book is The Real Mad Men, The Renegades of Madison Avenue and the Golden Age of Advertising, published by The Running Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Keep